This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suheep, coming up on Africa News Tonight.
An attack on a humanitarian convoy in South Sudan has been condemned by the head of the International Organization for Migration. And the Ethiopian government is blaming cattle herders from South Sudan for killing 12 people.
We'll have these stories, lots more, ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, the head of the International Organization for Migration has condemned an attack on a humanitarian convoy in South Sudan. The attack left 2 people dead and 3 injured. William Lacey Swing says the tragic attack on IOM staff, health workers, and civilians is appalling. It took place 2 days ago when a convoy was traveling to Ural East County. Ambassador Swing says one of the vehicles was ambushed by unknown gunmen, adding their identity and motivation remain unknown. Swing says the assault took place in an area of South Sudan in dire need of assistance due to a deadly cholera outbreak. He says Ural East County has been overwhelmed by a huge lack of basic necessities due to conflict, famine, and health epidemics.
The Ethiopian government is blaming cattle herders from South Sudan for killing 12 people and kidnapping more than 20 others in western Ethiopia. AFP quotes a government spokesman as saying the attack took place this week in the Gambela region near the South Sudan border. He blames the attack on Murel cattle herders, saying they want to abduct children and use them as shepherds. He says the Ethiopian military is in hot pursuit and that the military has already killed, captured, or wounded some of them. AFP says in a similar incident in April of last year, attackers from South Sudan killed more than 200 people in Ethiopia and kidnapped more than 100 children. Most of them have been freed.
Naval forces in Somalia's Puntland region traded fire today with men reportedly trying to ferry supplies to a hijacked oil tanker. VOA's Somali service says the incident occurred near the shore, wounding 2 people in the town of Habo. The owners of the hijacked ship, the RS-13, have made contact with the ship and say the Sri Lankan crew members are safe. Hijackers boarded the vessel Monday while it was en route from Djibouti to Mogadishu. They identify themselves as fishermen, not pirates. They're demanding compensation for illegal fishing conducted off the Somali coast. However, there's no word on how much compensation they want.
The government spokesman in the Democratic Republic of Congo has criticized the United Nations after 2 of its officials were kidnapped in the center of the country on Sunday. The spokesman says his government had not been informed of their movements. For VOA, William Klaus has the latest from Kinshasa, the Congolese capital.
The 2 UN officials have been missing since Sunday. Michael Sharp, an American, and Zahida Catalin, a Swedish citizen, as well as the 4 Congolese nationals accompanying them, were kidnapped in the province of Kasai Central, in the interior of the DRC. The UN mission in the DRC, known as MONUSCO, and the Congolese security forces have been looking for the 6 since being informed of their abduction, but so far without success. On Wednesday evening, VOA spoke to the DRC's communications minister, Lambert Mende. He says the government did not even know that Sharp and Catalin were in the country and that such methods are not acceptable. Mende says UN officials are free to carry out their inquiries and humanitarian work, but that it is nonetheless necessary to inform the authorities. The Kasai region where the kidnapping took place has been the scene of an escalating conflict between the DRC's security forces and militiamen since August of last year, when the Congolese military killed a customary chief known as Kamwina Nsapu. A militia of his followers is now active in the 3 provinces of Kasai and Lamami province, More than 400 people have been killed and 200,000 displaced by the violence, according to the UN's Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. The DRC's interior minister told Jeune Afrique, a French magazine, that it was members of this militia who carried out the attack. Mende told VOA that if they had informed the local authorities, they could have provided an escort or warned them that there was a problem, because the area is an operational zone where armed groups are active. Sharp and Catalin are members of the UN's group of experts on the DRC, which carries out research into conflict in the country and reports directly to the Security Council. The UN has more than 19,000 peacekeeping troops in the DRC, but most are deployed in the east rather than the country's centre. William Clowes for VOA News, Kinshasa.
Boko Haram militants attacked a northern Nigerian town yesterday, looting food supplies and burning homes. Residents tell AFP the attack occurred in Magumari, about 50 kilometers northwest of the Borno state capital of Maiduguri. Residents say Boko Haram overwhelmed a military base and police station before attacking the town. However, Nigeria's military says it repelled the militants and neutralized many of the attackers. Recently, Boko Haram has resorted to suicide bombings, often using teenage girls to carry out the attacks. Assaults on towns had become rare after a multinational military offensive was launched against it several years ago.
Morocco's King Mohammed VI will appoint a new prime minister after firing the man who held the job. A statement says the king took action to end a five-month deadlock in forming a new coalition government. Former Prime Minister Abdelila Benkeren is a member of the Islamist Party for Justice and Development, a branch of the Muslim Brotherhood. The nominee to replace him is also expected to come from the same party. The PJD party won the October elections, but failed to win a clear majority.
Tunisia was the birthplace of the Arab Spring, a series of popular uprisings that swept Egypt, Libya, Yemen, and Syria. But Tunisia has proven to be the only success story so far. Tunisia's foreign minister is urging the Trump administration to bolster U.S.-Tunisia ties. He says Tunisia's development and influence in the region is crucial to the U.S. and the world. From Washington, VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy has the story.
In a discussion at the U.S. Institute of Peace, Foreign Minister Khemayez Jinawi explained why Tunisia should matter to the new U.S. administration, whether in its partnership to fight terrorism, stabilizing troubled Libya, or as a major non-NATO ally of the United States.
Tunisia and the United States enjoy long-standing ties of friendship and cooperation. These ties need today and more than ever to be further strengthened and diversified for the mutual interest of our two friendly countries and peoples. Tunisia is a strategic ally to the United States and a trusted partner and friend in the region.
While Tunisia managed to navigate a peaceful political transition after the post-2011 political crisis and occasional flares of violence, the country is fighting recruitment efforts by violent extremist groups. It has suffered terror attacks within its own borders. The war in neighboring Libya has worsened regional security. Tunisia is involved in a fragile peace process to resolve that conflict.
President Beji Caid Sibsi launched in mid-December 2016 an initiative associating two other neighboring countries, namely Algeria and Egypt, with the aim of working to facilitate a direct contact between the Libyan faction in order to reach a comprehensive political settlement in the framework of the UN-sponsored agreement on December 2015.
According to a White House statement, President Trump praised Tunisia's stability and security in a February 17th phone call with Tunisian President Beji Caid Sibsi. The Tunisian foreign minister said President Trump's first phone call with the Tunisian president is a good sign. He said the U.S. might continue to work cooperatively with moderate Muslim political leaders who can contribute to global stability and help to reduce violent extremism.
It is a fact that the United States support, through several mechanisms, programs, as well as financial and military assistance, was a significant contribution to in Tunisia efforts to build a modern and democratic state, offering a model and an alternative to radicalism and to all forms of extremism.
Tunisia adopted a new constitution in 2014 that embraced values of human rights, inclusive politics, and reforms in pivotal areas such as the security forces. It's also undertaking deep reforms to revive its economy and accelerate development. But according to Jinawi, the young democracy needs more U.S. support to become a role model for transition to democracy in the Arab world. Mohammed Al-Shinawi, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, 16 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. An attack on a humanitarian convoy in South Sudan has been condemned by the head of the International Organization for Migration. The Ethiopian government is blaming cattle herders from South Sudan for killing 12 people. And a northern Nigerian town was attacked by Boko Haram militants yesterday. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
Farmers in southern Niger are receiving long-term help thanks to a $13 million effort by Lutheran World Relief and USAID. It's part of a large five-year $41 million initiative to fight poverty in West Africa's Sahel region, one of the poorest regions in the world. The innovative project called 12-12 Alliance aims to benefit more than 100,000 people with a focus on women and girls. It includes building agricultural productivity and resilience to climate-related disasters and seeks to build 12-month food security in Niger. Tim McCulley is Senior VP for International Programs for Lutheran World Relief. He spoke with me about their comprehensive investment in fighting poverty in the Sahel region.
Lutheran World Relief really has been working in the Sahel, specifically in Niger, Burkina Faso, and Mali, for close to 30 years now, working specifically to help small farmers and their families grow enough food to feed their families, earn enough income from their production, and participate in the agricultural value chains. This latest initiative represents a five-year push that really is an effort to build the long-term resilience of families living in very drought-prone areas so that when droughts and other climate change-related disasters do strike, they're less inclined to slip back into the poverty.
So basically the effort is to make it a long-term, sustainable type of environment where they can continue to produce even in severe weather conditions?
Exactly. I think what we found is that building the resilience of farming communities is a long-term process, particularly as we've seen over the last 10 or 15 years, the frequency and the scale of droughts that are affecting these populations are becoming more and more severe. And so part of what we have to do is take a long-term approach, knowing that people are living in very vulnerable climates and with very vulnerable and insecure economic conditions.
You have also pointed out that this initiative will help women and girls. How specifically will women and girls benefit from this?
In several ways, and I think that's a really important question that acknowledges the need to include women, girls, as well as men and boys in all of our work. The efforts that we're undertaking really look to include women and girls in several specific ways. First, by helping them organize through agricultural cooperatives and small self-help groups under which women are able to access loans. Women are able to access veterinary services for the livestock and the small ruminants that they have, and that women are more integrated into the ability to participate in the local markets for crops like onions, millet, sorghum, etc.
You touched on this earlier, how this initiative will help farmers to cope with weather disasters brought on by climate change. What would be an example that is maybe already in place that is working?
A lot of what we will be doing is not just helping farmers increase the quantity of their crop, but to do so in a way that practices sound agronomy. For example, a lot of work will be spent on ensuring that water resources are properly managed, helping to restore the soil fertility in areas that are affected by drought, so that when the droughts do come, the water and the land and the soil are better equipped to help survive that drought.
What is the biggest issue right now that is facing the farmers there in the Sahel?
I think that there really are two overriding concerns. One is that this is a region that has been experiencing chronic poverty for decades and decades and decades, and understanding that helping people move out of that poverty path is a long-term process. The second really, as you've mentioned, is the fact that it's clear that the climate is changing, that the rain patterns are not as predictable as they once were, and helping farmers navigate those changing climates is really important. I think that the second factor that is particularly affecting people in parts of northern Mali and in places like southeast Niger is that there is growing insecurity brought about by a variety of tribal and religious and terrorist activities, all of which make it harder to access the land, harder for farmers to participate in local markets, and have created a real environment of insecurity and instability that is just compounding their already difficult circumstances.
So what has been the response so far of some of the initiatives?
What we've clearly seen is that in communities where Lupin World Relief has been working, that when crises do occur, those communities are less in need of emergency assistance. And that really, I think, to us is proof that taking a long-term approach can help people avoid slipping back into food insecurity and into abject poverty when these crises do occur.
Tim McCulley is Senior VP for International Programs for Lutheran World Relief. He spoke with me from Baltimore, Maryland.
The mid-1960s was an exciting, often dangerous time. It was the height of the Cold War, and the space race between the United States and the Soviet Union was neck and neck. It was also the moment when Zambia, then Northern Rhodesia, achieved independence from Great Britain. Enter Edward Mukuku Onkoloso, a Zambian schoolteacher and political activist who attempted to start a homegrown Zambian space program. He wanted to beat the superpowers to the moon and Mars. He didn't get there, but his odyssey makes for a tantalizing footnote to history. To find out more, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Namawili Sarpel, an associate professor of English at the University of California at Berkeley. She's the author of The Zambian Afronaut, who wanted to join the space race, which recently appeared in the New Yorker magazine. Sarpel began her conversation with Adam Phillips by describing the rather clumsy debut of Nkoloso's first rocket.
The Zambian space program technically was supposed to launch on the day of independence, October 24th, 1964, at the Independence Day celebrations. And apparently, Nkoloso rolled his 10-foot copper cylinder into the proceedings, proposing to launch. And a British official walked up to him, questioned his presence at the ceremony altogether, kicked it, and it fell over and fell apart. There are other people who say that it actually did launch about 10 feet in the air and then came down.
He wasn't doing this alone. He had acolytes, right? Disciples.
Yeah, he was training a bunch of space cadets, as he called them. Sometimes he called them brothers and sisters of the heavens. And he was going to send them to Mars and to the moon.
So who was he? Was he a performance artist? Was he just a nut? Was he a political activist with a very good PR idea? Who was this guy?
That's what intrigued me about his story. The artistic projects that have taken him up, they basically argue that he was a kind of dreamer or visionary, a kind of early pioneer in what we call Afrofuturism now. But reporters from the time considered him a fool or a crackpot, someone who didn't know what he was doing and didn't understand how many resources he would need to actually launch a space program. That said, from the very start, he was asking for money. So he knew that huge funds would be needed for this to actually happen. So he wasn't completely naive. He also had the sense of being very resourceful. It was kind of a do-it-yourself sensibility. So for his training, he used empty oil barrels and he would put his space cadets inside and roll them downhill to simulate the feeling of weightlessness. This is a kind of training that he would have picked up from his time in the war. He had fought for the British in World War II. And he gave his cadets different assignments, learning how to work with explosives and chemicals. He swung them from trees. He was trying to kind of build their spirit.
Was there a spiritual dimension to what he was doing? What did he think he was about?
When I looked at some of the things that he said about the space program, I found it very difficult to read his tone. For example, when he wrote an op-ed, he discussed the fact that they had already seen Mars from their telescopes and that they'd noticed that Mars was populated by primitive natives and that one of his space girls was going to be launched there as well as a missionary. And he said, quote, "I have warned the missionary he must not force Christianity to the people if they do not want it." At one point, he shook a kind of spear at the moon and he said, "I want to die out there." There was a sense that the moon or Mars was going to be a kind of afterlife for him in some ways.
And yet there seems to be a strong patriotic underpinning to a lot of this.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things he said is, "This is our heavenly destiny, our natural ambition, and our cultural hegemony." And he very specifically said, "Our black scientists are going to be the ones to get us into outer space first." And he said, "Most people in the world don't even know who we are or where we are on the map." And in some ways, I think Nkoloso put Zambia on the map in his attempt to get off the world altogether. There's a sense in which he was keenly aware that to dream in some ways is the first step. And indeed, man landed on the moon in 1969.
I know that he and Kenneth Kaunda, Zambia's first president, were friends in childhood and that they were revolutionaries and activists together, each in their own very different styles.
And Kaunda went on to be president. And Nkoloso, this kind of eccentric figure next to him, would show up at rallies and kind of rev the crowd up before Kaunda would speak. So it's a fascinating story of these two men who continue to be friends after independence as well, but have very different personas when it comes to what it means to start a new nation.
That was Professor Namwali Serpell of the University of California at Berkeley. Namwali is the author of The Zambian Astronaut Who Wanted to Join the Space Race, which recently appeared in the New Yorker magazine. She spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Sidrak Franklin, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Interested in deeper analysis of news and events in Africa? Then plan to join me, Douglas Impuga, on Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll have African journalists and expert guests discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. So plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And Our 5 minutes newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.